Today is Thursday, November 26th, Thanksgiving Day in the U.S., and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Argentinian soccer great Diego Maradona died Wednesday.
He suffered a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, less than a month after his 60th birthday and just weeks after undergoing brain surgery.
Plus, why did France choose now to levy taxes on U.S. tech giants?
Because right now you have huge pressure in France due to the pandemic with the lack of revenue for the French.
And President Trump issues a pardon in the waning days of his administration. All these stories and more next. Argentinian soccer great Diego Maradona has died. Maradona was among the best players in history and led his country to the 1986 World Cup title before later struggling with cocaine use and obesity. Reuters reporter Adam Reed has the details.
Soccer World Cup winner and one of the sport's biggest icons, Diego Maradona, died on Wednesday. He suffered a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, less than a month after his 60th birthday and just weeks after undergoing brain surgery. Maradona is described by many as the best ever soccer player. His greatest achievement came at the 1986 World Cup, where he was instrumental in Argentina's eventual victory. In the quarter-final against England, he scored two of the most famous goals of all time. First came the notorious Hand of God, where he punched the ball into the net, followed by a sublime solo dribbling effort past most of the opposition before hitting the target. But his career also suffered tremendous lows, starting with defeat in the final of the 1990 World Cup. That was followed by a failed drug test at the tournament 4 years later in the United States, when Maradona was ultimately sent home in disgrace. Years of drug use, overeating and alcoholism punctured his stellar career. He nearly died of a cocaine-induced heart failure in 2000. Maradona's club career saw him win trophies in his native Argentina with Boca Juniors, in Spain with Barcelona, and most famously in Italy with Napoli, where he is still held in great affection. He also edged out his great Brazilian rival Pelé to be named FIFA's Player of the Century.
That was Reuters' Adam Reed. France's finance ministry has set out notices to big tech companies liable for its digital service tax to pay the levies as planned in December. The U.S. companies affected are Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple, or GAFA as they're collectively known. I got the details from reporter Nicolas Pinot in Paris via WhatsApp.
Well, we are talking about the 3% levy on the profits from these big technology companies, mainly U.S., but you have also digital advertising and other companies. To give you an idea, I mean, last year, this tax is brought into $475 million for French Treasury, and it's expected to grow next year. So we know this. Big companies, they receive the announcement this week, and they expect to make the first payment that is required by December and to pay the remainder for next year. So pretty big and pretty important, and we know there have been discussions between France and the U.S. about that. And there's also fear now in France among experts that the U.S. Might retaliate, you know, with some tariffs, especially on wine, cosmetics, or also some, champagne or cheese. So it's a pretty big deal here in France.
So why did France go ahead and begin this process? As I understand it, there was an agreement between Washington and France not to levy the tax against the American tech companies as long as Washington and Paris were trying to work out a deal through the OECD. So what happened?
You're right. I mean, it used to be a truce between Paris and Washington about the issue. And some people, they think that the French administration, they move on with this tax because right now you have huge pressure in France due to the pandemic with the lack of revenue for the French treasury. And the fact that these such U.S. Tech companies have huge amount of profits, especially during the pandemic. To give you an example, Amazon said between the lockdown measures in France, its sales went up between 40 and 50% just for the health restriction period. So there is a lot of anger in France to go after these big giant companies because people are saying they do not pay their fair share. But it's also true that since the U.S. Put out of the talks held by the OECD back in June, there was supposed to be a period where French will wait for the, and Europeans in general will wait for the outcome of the U.S. election. And since we knew that President-elect Biden is supposed to take over in January, people were expecting Europeans to wait until January to bring that back to the table, because with the OECD talks, they had until June 2021 to reach an agreement. So the timing is a little bit odd, but again, in France, you have a lot of pressure against the government to go after these big U.S. companies.
Speaking of President-elect Biden, has there been any kind of reaction posted in French media, either from the tech companies or from the United States?
No, so far, we haven't seen any official statements. But I will say, though, that the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, he said it was not a long time ago. It was right after the outcome of the U.S. election. It was 2 weeks ago. He said, and I quote, digital giants are now the adversaries of the governments. It's still about, you know, tax evasions and the aggressive techniques by those big tech companies for making a lot of profit. So they do not expect a radical shift position from the U.S. administration, but they think that with President-elect Biden coming to the White House and his administration, they're going to have more leverage to improve the tone of the discussion to reach an agreement by next year. Although we have to say on the U.S. side, and it's not about a matter of Trump or Biden, but you have a huge consensus in Washington at the Congress that Europeans shouldn't go after U.S. Technology companies, and that it will be unfair retaliation against those companies.
Nicolas Pineau reports from Paris, France. News reports say U.S. President Donald Trump falsely claimed that he won the 2020 election and made unfounded allegations of voter fraud instead of President-elect Joe Biden when he called into an event organized by Pennsylvania Republicans in Gettysburg.
So this was a very sad to say it. This election was rigged, and we can't let that happen. We can't let it happen for our country. And this election has to be turned around because we won Pennsylvania by a lot, and we won all of these swing states by a lot.
Trump has yet to concede, even though Pennsylvania on Tuesday certified Biden as the winner in the state, and as the formal transition process has begun. State election officials and international observers have insisted that there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud, and Trump's legal team has repeatedly lost its cases in court. President Trump on Wednesday also pardoned former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. The move takes direct aim in the final days of his administration at the Russia investigation into interference in the 2016 election. Trump has long insisted the investigation was motivated by political bias. Trump announced the pardon on Wednesday, calling it his great honor. Flynn is the second Trump associate convicted in the Russia probe to be granted clemency by the president. Representative Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, said that the president has abused the pardon power to reward his friends and political allies and protect those who lie to cover up for him. Iran's state television says Iran's president has reiterated his hope President-elect Joe Biden will return America's Iran policy to where he left things as vice president 4 years ago and return to the nuclear deal the United States and its other world powers negotiated. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that story.
Hassan Rouhani says if Iran and the U.S. could find a path back to the situation on January 20, 2017, President Donald Trump's inauguration day, it could be a huge solution for many issues and problems. Under Trump, tensions between the U.S. and Iran have escalated. Rouhani has called on Biden to explicitly condemn Trump's maximum pressure campaign, as well as compensate for wrong policies pursued over the last 4 years, a possible reference to the massive financial losses Iran has suffered as a result of Trump's sanctions campaign. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
President-elect Joe Biden is continuing to move forward with his transition to the Oval Office. One of the key national security offices he will need to fill is the head of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden explains the role of the ODNI, its relationship to the Defense and Homeland Security departments, and who the Biden administration is looking to fill the post.
Well, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, like the Department of Homeland Security, was set up and created after the 9/11 terror attacks so that there would be almost a central clearinghouse for all the disparate intelligence streams that are coming into the United States to different intelligence agencies so that the country would have a better way of connecting the different dots and not missing something that could have tipped them off and perhaps have prevented an attack like the ones the country saw on 9/11. So essentially, the Director of National Intelligence is the nation's top intelligence official, and they will oversee all the different intelligence agencies, work with the different intelligence agencies, all 17 of them, including the nation's top spy master, who is the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, to present the lawmakers and especially the president and the administration a coherent view of what the intelligence is saying so that they can go about making policy on how to react.
So as we enter this transition period between the Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration, who is President-elect Biden choosing to head up the ODNI?
He selected Avril Haines, who would be notable for a couple of reasons. First of all, she would be the first woman to serve in the role as Director of National Intelligence. But she also has a history with Biden from the Obama administration and President Barack Obama. She was Obama's principal deputy national security advisor. And she's also has experience with the CIA, where she was the first woman to serve as deputy director. And so she's got a good sense of the playing field. Former officials that we've talked to have said that she really understands the different roles that one needs to play within the intelligence agency in terms of how to deal with the rank and file members, the people who do the intelligence and analyze the intelligence, and also how to reach out to lawmakers and to the administration. And most importantly, what they say is that she lives up to the ethos that the U.S. intelligence community likes to put out there, which is that they speak truth to power, that no matter what the policy decisions may be or the preferences, policy preferences of an administration may be, they are going to deliver the intelligence as objectively as possible so that policymakers, whether they like it or not, know what's going on to the best of anyone's ability to understand. And in introducing her earlier this week, President-elect Biden said that's one of the reasons that he selected her, because he knew she would tell him the truth.
Now, this is a position that needs to be confirmed by the Senate. So what are her chances and what challenges could she face?
People who have worked with her, who know her, don't expect that she'll have too much trouble for dealing with lawmakers and being able to relate to them. The other big challenge, though, is she's coming in to an intelligence community in the United States where many former officials have been extremely worried. They say it's been politicized under the Trump administration like never before, that rather than in its traditional role of speaking truth to power and just providing policymakers with intelligence, that decisions were made by some of the president's appointees, and most recently the current director of national intelligence, John Ratcliffe, who was a former Republican lawmaker, that seem to them appear to be designed to go along with the president's policy preferences. So she's going to have an intelligence community that has been grappling with this shift. Like so many agencies in government, where traditional norms were abandoned under Trump, new norms were put in place, and she's going to have to perhaps find a way to walk that back. And in the eyes of some, they think she's going to have the challenge of having to restore credibility to U.S. intelligence agencies, so both the public and lawmakers see it as a source of information and not a source of political spin.
That was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Responding to President Trump's order to remove 2,000 troops from Afghanistan and 500 troops from Iraq, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said a rapid withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan now would hurt U.S. allies and delight the people who wish the U.S. harm. David DeRoche, an associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, explained the strategic impact of U.S. reduction of forces in Afghanistan and Iraq to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy.
basically, I think it's pretty much everybody at least agrees that President Trump's days on the national stage are drawing to a close. And, you know, Senator McConnell has to look forward to life after Trump. And so, you know, his sentiment is pretty much widely shared across the foreign policy establishment that this is a precipitous withdrawal that owes more to Trump's desire to say that he kept the campaign promise rather than to any tactical consideration. There's also a feeling that this withdrawal, the way it was ordered, is undercutting the negotiations with the Taliban that are underway in Doha. So I think McConnell's remarks reflect both of those facts.
General Kenneth McKenzie, the top military officer in charge of operations in the Middle East, has repeatedly said that the Taliban have still not shown conclusively that they are going to break with Al-Qaeda. From a strategic point of view, is the timing right for reduction of U.S. forces in Afghanistan?
I think that honestly, if you look at it, Al-Qaeda is pretty much a spent force. So if that is the sole war aim that we have, then that's fine. I think you can make that case. But the problem is, you know, the U.S. goals in Afghanistan have evolved. What we want is a stable Afghan government. We want to see an end to Taliban attacks on the Afghan government. We've seen no indication of any of that from the Taliban. So it's almost as if rather than negotiate for these things, we've just decided to leave and see what happens on the ground. And that is of concern. You know, that will amount to a betrayal of our partners in Afghanistan. It reflects the frustration that in 18 years, they've made remarkably little progress towards building a stable, self-sustaining state.
Would the reduction of American forces in Iraq allow Iran to increase its influence in Iraq?
Iran's got a lot of influence in Iraq, regardless of how many U.S. forces there are, primarily because Iran, you know, uses proxy forces, and they're not really constrained by issues of morality or legality or any, you know, coalitions. They're not accountable to an assembly. Paradoxically, if we reduce forces in a way that allow us to concentrate in a series of hardened positions rather than spread out vulnerable ones, that may actually increase the American position. We may be in a better position to take offensive action against the various Iraqi proxies, such as the ones who just rocketed the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, killed an Iraqi children a few days.
Could President-elect Joe Biden raise the numbers in Iraq and Afghanistan back once he takes office in January, while he also promised to bring U.S. troops home?
Well, he did promise to bring U.S. troops home. He is known as a person who opposes lots of U.S. troops in the region. But he can say, and other presidents have done this, once they take office, to say, I'm sorry, the situation has changed. And he might wish to do so. It might be smart politics just to show, to underline the difference between him and Donald Trump. So that is something he could do. But it's more likely that he'll just say, okay, anything bad that happened here is the fault of the administration before me, and I'm going to working from this point forward.
David DeRoche is an associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Still to come.
We haven't had Thanksgiving as a family in 12 years, so yeah, with flights kind of being cheap. And I already had COVID, so I was like, perfect, I can go somewhere.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers led by Nobel laureate Adam Riess of the Space Telescope Science Institute and Johns Hopkins University used the Hubble Space Telescope to track and image a supernova for a year. Called SN 2018 GV, the supernova is described as a Type 1A supernova. Type 1A supernovas are used by astronomers to measure the expansion of the universe, something Riess and his team were doing when they tracked the supernova. The Hubble captured detailed images of the exploding star as it began as a very bright star until it faded into the darkness of interstellar space. According to the team, the supernova is in a barred spiral galaxy called NGC 2525, which is about 70 million light years away in the constellation Puppis. If you want to take a look at the time-lapse video, visit spacetelescope.org. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Thai protesters called on King Maha Wachiralongkorn to give up control of a royal fortune valued in the tens of billions of dollars Wednesday, as the latest in months of demonstrations focus squarely on the monarchy. Reuters' Olivia Chan has the details.
Mocked up banknotes are the latest creation by Thai anti-government protesters. They are branded with rubber ducks, an emblem of the demonstrations. Protesters made calls for the king to give up control of the royal fortune on Wednesday. The crown assets are estimated to be worth more than $30 billion. Mai is a protester.
At first, we intended for the banknotes to be coupons for protesters to use and buy food at the demonstration. But people now want them as souvenirs instead. We also chose the duck on the banknotes because it became a symbol in the fight, protecting us.
The demonstration on Wednesday came a day after police summoned many of the best-known protest leaders on charges of insulting the monarchy, which can mean up to 15 years in prison. It had originally been scheduled at the Crown Property Bureau, which manages the royal assets. But after police built siege barricades of shipping containers and razor wire, the venue was moved to the headquarters of the Siam Commercial Bank. The king holds 23% of the bank's stake, making him the biggest shareholder. 28-year-old protester, known by the nickname Gift, said there are too many unanswered questions about the monarchy.
We could not scrutinize anything about the monarchy. There were many questions left unanswered, whether it would be the monarch's assets or the taxes that they used. The people were left with so many unanswered questions.
The palace has made no comment since the protests began. But when the king was asked about the protesters recently, he said they were, quote, loved all the same. Since July, protesters have been calling for the removal of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, a former junta leader. The protesters also seek to make the king more accountable under the constitution.
Olivia Chan reports for Reuters News. Ethiopia's government-appointed Human Rights Commission has accused a youth group in the rebellious Tigray region of carrying out an atrocious massacre of hundreds of civilians aided by the Tigrayan security forces. Tigray People's Liberation Front did not immediately comment on the commission's report, though it previously has denied involvement in the killings. Interrupted phone and internet connections in the Tigray region also make it difficult for journalists to independently verify the information. Americans are now traveling in large numbers to spend the Thanksgiving holiday with family and friends. This is despite a warning from the Centers for Disease Control to stay home. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
Thursday is Thanksgiving in the U.S., and millions of Americans are flocking to airports, train stations, and taking to the roads to spend time with loved ones, despite warnings from the Centers for Disease Control to stay home. People like Becca Yanez, who bought her airplane tickets.
We haven't had Thanksgiving as a family in 12 years, so yeah, with flights kind of being cheap. And I already had COVID, so I was like, perfect, I can go somewhere.
Experts say that doesn't guarantee immunity. Some have gotten it more than once. Students are returning home from college, either for the holiday or for longer. Will Mason's college canceled in-person classes.
But I guess I don't really have an option there.
Infectious disease experts are sympathetic. Dr. Catherine Lay is with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center.
And I understand the desire during this time of year. We've had such a hard year, and it's time for the holidays, and we want to be around friends and family, but it's so important to stay at home.
Doctors like Lay are focused on the rising infection rate.
I mean, every single day, it's a new record that's very discouraging.
It's hard to follow CDC guidelines to stay 1.8 meters apart at airports, highway rest stops, and at train stations. Lay recommends eating outdoors if possible, keeping the windows open at home if indoors, avoiding crowds at restaurants, not standing in line anywhere.
And the primary mode of transmission that we really need to focus on is the respiratory droplets. So hence this kind of shift in recommendations to you have to wear a mask, please wear a mask, everybody wear a mask, and keep social distance.
And more bad news. Millions of Americans will travel the weekend after Thanksgiving and risk getting the virus or spreading it on their way home or once they get there. Public health experts are alarmed. Here's Dr. Joe Gerald at the University of Arizona.
We have a terrible 2 to 3 weeks ahead of us. If we don't make changes to our behaviors and our policies, the 3 weeks after that will be even worse.
Experts expect COVID rates throughout the U.S. to explode just before Christmas and the New Year's holidays, in part because of the Thanksgiving celebrations. And that's something the rest of the world should watch carefully as these other holidays get closer. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Beyoncé dominated the nominations for the 2021 Grammy Awards, which were notable by a stunning snub for Canadian singer The Weeknd and a first for K-pop sensation BTS. Reuters' Gloria So has it all.
Superstars and newcomers alike are among next year's Grammy Awards nominations. Beyoncé led the pack with 9 nominations on Tuesday, making her the second most nominated artist in Grammy's history. Her releases Black Parade and Black is King celebrated black culture during a year of racial turmoil in the United States. British singer Dua Lipa, pop star Taylor Swift, and rapper Roddy Ricch all followed Beyoncé with 6 nominations apiece. But the biggest surprise was R&B singer The Weeknd being shut out from the awards entirely in what Variety called the biggest snub in memory. He dominated music charts this year with his critically acclaimed album After Hours and hit single Blinding Lights. The Weeknd fired back on Twitter, accusing the Grammys of being corrupt. However, this year's awards will mark a first for a South Korean group, with K-pop sensation BTS scoring their first major Grammy nod with a nomination in Best Pop Group Performance for their song Dynamite. The Grammys will be hosted by Daily Show comedian Trevor Noah in Los Angeles on January 31st.
That was Reuters' Gloria So, and you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Sometime between September 21st and November 11th, 1621, 53 English men, women, and children were joined by some 90 Native American tribesmen in a feast to give thanks for their first harvest in their new home, the Plymouth Colony, in today's Massachusetts. They had much to be thankful for. Just 1 year earlier, in mid-November 1620, they were part of a group of 102 colonists and 30 crew who reached the shores of North America aboard a ship named Mayflower. They were Puritans, religious separatists who were considered to be radicals and therefore illegal by the government of England, their home country. Tired of persecution in Europe, they were headed for the colony of Virginia, but the winter weather forced them to drop anchor on Cape Cod, over 350 kilometers northeast of their chosen destination. Nonetheless, the hopeful colonists decided to settle on the mainland, just across the bay from their original anchorage on Cape Cod, and began to set up a community wherein they could live according to their own religious beliefs. That first year was hard and came close to ending the colony before it took root. Within a year, nearly half of the 102 colonists were dead due to starvation, disease, and the harsh weather conditions. But the summer brought a good harvest, and in autumn, 22 men, 4 women, 9 adolescent boys, 5 adolescent girls, and 13 young children sat down to celebrate with their native Wampanoag neighbors. Massachusetts was not the first to claim that their state was the first to celebrate Thanksgiving. Numerous historical documents indicate that Spanish explorers and other English colonists celebrated religious services of Thanksgiving in Florida, Texas, Maine, and Virginia long before 1620. However, these were isolated local celebrations that did not survive the test of time. So, thanks to vigorous lobbying by the state of Massachusetts, modern Thanksgiving was first officially established in all states in 1863 by a presidential proclamation of Abraham Lincoln. The observance was moved to the fourth week in November by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Thanksgiving began as a prayer of gratitude by immigrants who, if not for the support of their native neighbors, would most likely have not survived their first year in North America. Today, although Thanksgiving is traditionally a gathering of family and friends, the threat to life and health by the COVID-19 pandemic will see many celebrate home alone, once again offering their gratitude for a chance at a bright future.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.